Finally, this is the final podcast for Heaney, number two, where we're just going to look at clearances and keeping going. Clearances is an 8-poem sequence written in the late 80s for the death of his mother, MKH, Marie Catherine Heaney. And we're not going to look at all of them. We're going to look at maybe 3 or 4 of these, and then we're going to look at Keeping Going, a poem for and about his brother. So Clearances, right, this series of sonnets, again, love poems, right? And it's about, as I said, the death of his mother. But his mother, of course, right, Seamus doing Seamus, right, starts out, his mother barely makes an appearance. In fact, she doesn't appear in the first poem at all. She barely makes an appearance in the second poem. And the third poem is where she comes in. Why? Because the first two poems are what Seamus does, that drop back into memory. He can't talk about his mom without talking about, he's going to in fact start with a great-grandmother, his great-grandmother, so his mother's grandmother, and then his grandfather, his mother's father, and then finally in poem 3 start to talk about his mom and his relationship with his mom. Poem 1 starts with this cobble, a big stone, paving stone, thrown 100 years ago, and it is literally a cobblestone that is thrown because Seamus's great-grandmother on his mother's side, one of his great-grandmothers, converted from Protestantism to Catholicism because she fell in love with a Catholic boy, and she converted. And this poem is set on the day that they first go to church, and she's not going to church with the other members of the village who are going to the Protestant church. She's going to the Catholic church in town, right? And all her friends and neighbors, people that she had grown up with, right? People that had known her family for literally hundreds of years, stood out there that Sunday morning and stoned the new couple, threw rocks at this new couple as they drove through town. And Seamus had one of these rocks, right? This cobble thrown 100 years ago, right? She's couched low in the trap. The trap is the cart, right? Running the gauntlet that first Sunday down the Braid of Mass at a panic gallop, right? Call her the convert to the exogamous bride. He says, it's a genre piece inherited on my mother's side and mine to dispose with now she's gone. Instead of silver and Victorian lace, right? Instead of the usual things you get passed down from your parents, instead of your usual inheritance, the family silver or some piece of Victorian lace or some piece really nice, I got this rock that is, as he says, exonerating, meaning it removes guilt and exonerated because it didn't do anything wrong. It was used as a device. This thing, right? My people have done their time. My people have suffered for what they believe in. Right? I am somehow exonerated from that, he says. And then the second poem here, when he reads this in public readings, as with Keeping Going, people always get a laugh. This always gets laughs for him because you can read this one of two ways. The very first way is you read it as a little kid being given last-minute instructions, going to visit neighbors. He's going to visit his grandparents, right? And this is his mom telling him, right? You know, you remember what it was like when you were little, right? What did your parents tell you when you went out? Right? As he says, the kettle whistled, they got an unchipped set, the linoleum's polished, everything's shiny, right? The china cups are white and big, right? Everything's present and correct. The butter must be kept out of the sun, and don't be dropping crumbs. Don't tilt your chair. Don't reach. Don't point. Don't make noise when you stir. It is number 5, New Row, the land of the dead. Oh, yeah. If you've had to go as a kid to visit relatives' house, especially while they're going to go visiting or whatever, man, it is definitely the land of the dead there, right? There's nothing for a kid to do. And then we get grandfather rising from his place with spectacles pushed back on a clean bald head to welcome a bewildered homing daughter before she even knocks. What's this? What's this? And they sit down in the shining room together. And yeah, you can read that. It makes complete sense to read that as a young kid thinking about his mom taking him to visit his grandparents. But at a completely different level, and a level that makes sense, I think makes more sense with a lot of the imagery here. Look at it. It's all white. It's clean. It's shiny. It's big. It's perfect. It literally is the land of the dead. And why is his mother bewildered? Well, in life, she had visited that place hundreds of times. She wouldn't be bewildered. She wouldn't be puzzled or anything like that. No, but this is his mom dying, being welcomed into the afterlife by those who had preceded her, by her own father, who's got this clean, bald head, welcomes this bewildered, homing daughter, coming home, coming to heaven before she even, and they sit down and the room shines together. So you can read this completely differently as this place of perfection that his mother is going to here, right? This place, right? Because heaven, if it's not like coming home, I don't know why anybody would want to go there. Now, poem number three here is my favorite of all of these, right? Seamus actually likes number five because he says that captures their relationship best, the kind of being at cross purposes, one another, folding tiles. But I like this idea of peeling potatoes together. Remember, he's the oldest of nine kids. So you're not getting much alone time with your parents if you've got nine kids. Basically, you're helping to raise all the younger kids. So when all the others were away at Mass, I was all hers as we peeled potatoes. They broke the silence, let fall one by one, like solder weeping off the soldering iron. Cold comfort set between us. Things to share, gleaming in a bucket of clean water, and again let fall. Little pleasant splashes from each other's work would bring us to our senses. So while the parish priest at her bedside went hammer and tongs at prayers for the dying, and some were responding and some crying, I remembered her head bent towards my head, her breath in mine, our fluent dipping knives, never closer the whole rest of our lives. So for the first eight lines of this poem, he sets it up, right? He gives us this image. Again, it's this memory, it's this reconstruction, it's this bog of the mind image here, right, of when he and his mother peeling potatoes for Sunday dinner while everybody else was at church. They don't say a word. They just work over this bucket together, right? You're tying dinner for at least 11 people, right? Huge amount of potatoes that they're peeling. They don't say a word. They don't speak. They don't need to. They have an understanding that is deeper than words. Right? These cold comforts. And when does he recall this? The last six lines tell you. Right there at her hospital bed, right? And here's the parish priest who's there giving prayers for the dead or dying, right? And he's going hammer and tongs at it. Hammer and tongs, an image from basically blacksmithing. He's going at it loudly and lustily, right? Making a lot of noise. Some members of the family are responding. Some of them are crying. Seamus does what he always does. Steps back into the past, right? I remembered her head bent towards my head, her breath in mine, this mixture of the spirits in the breath. If you remember on Sengor, we talked about the breath of the spirit, the pneuma, our fluent dipping knives, that gorgeous line there, right? Fluency is something we associate with language, but they're silent. Their knives, their work, those are the things that are good and proficient. They do all the talking for them, right? There is a connection here that is deeper than words. We don't need words. And he says, never closer the whole rest of our lives. And if you want to look at number five, I think it's a nice poem. Like I said, Seamus thinks it's the best. We're going to look at number seven here, right? Because he's going to talk about what his father does at the moment of death, and what happens literally at the moment of death. In the last minutes, he said more to her almost than in their whole life together. You'll be in Neuro on Monday night, and I'll come up for you, and you'll be glad when I walk in the door. Isn't that right? His head was bent down to her propped up head. She could not hear, but we were overjoyed. He called her good and girl. Then she was dead. The searching for a pulse beat was abandoned, and we all knew one thing by being there. The space we stood around had been emptied into us to keep. It penetrated clearances that suddenly stood open. High cries were felled, and a pure change happened. So here again, right, the moment of his mother's death, right? And he's talking about his father. That's the he there, right? Who speaks more to her on her deathbed than almost in their whole life together. He wasn't a man of many words. And what he's telling her is something that they all know is a lie. You'll be in Nuro. You'll be back at home on Monday night. And I'll come up for you and you'll be glad. No. She couldn't even hear him. She was so far gone. But we, the family members, we were overjoyed. He called her good and girl. And then she was dead. And we stopped looking for a pulse beat because we knew it. And what we knew was one thing. The space we stood around had been emptied into us to keep. And there's lots of signification there, right? The space. That's no longer their mother that they're standing around. That is a space, a hole, a clearance, a clearing. Used to be full of something. Used to be full, if we're going to keep clearances, used to be full of things we planted in the ground once. But now, it's empty. And guess where that emptiness is also in us. It's been emptied into us to keep. So our memories of her keep her alive in a certain way. But there's also a hole and a gap where her presence no longer is. It penetrated these clearances, he says, within us. These holes within us that suddenly stood open. And instead of trees being felled, these high cries were felt. And a pure change happened. This ontological change that happens. That what was once there is now no longer. And the last poem we'll look at is this poem for his younger brother, Hugh. The guy who does take over the family farm. And it's kind of a commentary. If you look closely enough at the biography, you see that in the midst of the troubles, Seamus moves out of Northern Ireland and moves to what we would call the Republic of Ireland. Because he can't live in Northern Ireland anymore, surrounded by all this violence. But his brother stays there, and he kind of wants to know why. And he thinks he has the answer, what he wants to know why, and he wants to praise his brother for staying. And what he starts with is this great, in this first stanza, this great image of what his brother used to do, right? Seamus is not much of a jokester, as you can tell by the poetry. There's not a lot of humor here, if indeed there's any. But Hugh was always the guy who could get everybody to laugh and get everybody through things. And what Hugh would do is he would take a kitchen chair and throw it up over his shoulder and then take a paintbrush, a big wide paintbrush, and tie it around his waist. And he'd try to make himself look like a Scottish piper, right? Those Scottish pipers always have a fringed bag around their belt that's traditionally used to hold their powder. It's their powder bag, and that's known as a sporran. Hugh would take a brush that they used for whitewashing and tie that around and then make the legs of the kitchen chair look like the drone pipes from a Scottish bagpipes. And he'd do this little parades and stuff, right? The piper coming from far away is you with a whitewash brush for a sporran and wobbling around you. A kitchen chair upside down on your shoulder, your right arm pretending to tuck the bag beneath your elbow, your pop eyes and big cheeks nearly bursting with laughter, but keeping the drone going interminably between catches of breath. That's a great description of this, right? Again, stuck in the past. When they were young, this is what Hugh would do, kind of get all the kids together and they would do this. But these things are going to change. And in fact, it kind of gives the reason for why Seamus leaves. All these great images from when they were kids. And in fact, everything here except the last stanza is all about these wonderful things that happened to them when they were kids. The whitewash brush. Now, maybe I need to explain whitewashing, right? It's basically lime, quick lime, that's mixed with water. It's not like paint because it's water-based, but it turns into this gray stuff. And as it dries, it turns white. And so lots of farms use it. Here in America, it's usually not white, it's red. The idea of the red barn is where we get, right? It usually comes from this whitewashing. If you remember, I think it's Tom Sawyer, maybe, where he talks about whitewashing a fence, right? It's cheap, and it's something that you make the kids do because you have to do it every year. The whitewash brush, an old blanched, skirted thing on the back of the byre door, biding its time until spring air spelled lime in a work bucket and a pot stick to mix it in with water. Those smells brought tears to the eyes. We inhaled a kind of greeny burning and thought of brimstone. but the slop of the actual job of brushing walls, the watery gray being lashed on in broad swatches, then drying out whiter and whiter, all that worked like magic. Where had we come from? What was this kingdom we knew we'd been restored to? Our shadows moved on the wall and a tar border glittered the full length of the house. A black divide like a freshly opened, pungent, reeking trench. So he's talking about doing this every spring with his brother, him and Hugh. Right? They'd have to whitewash the house and whitewash the barn. One of them would get up on a ladder and reach up and down as far as he could, and the other would stay on the ground. And when they'd finish, there'd be a big strip in the center where they didn't get, where they didn't intersect. And as everything else turned white, that stayed black, as he says. That tar border glittered the full length of the house, this black divide. And he talks about it as it smells bad. It burns. It's heavy-duty burn, right? If you know Fight Club, the movie, right? When he burns his hand on the back of it, that's limestone. That's quicklime. It's lye that he's using to do that, right? It's so basic that it burns. Right? And then more images from when they were young. Piss at the gable, the dead will congregate, but separately. A little kind of old wives' tale that rural Irish people would tell young kids, right? If you get up in the middle of the river, this is before indoor plumbing, right? So the outhouse is maybe 40 yards away from the house. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's cold. Maybe there's snow on the ground, right? And you're a little boy. Are you walking all the way out to that outhouse? No. You're walking right outside the door, and you're leaving yourself there. But, hey, these people developed this story. Oh, yes, you know what? Pissing, as he says, piss at the gable, piss underneath the eaves of the house, piss close to the house, it attracts ghosts. Well, now, at 2 a.m, you got to decide if you're a little kid. Am I going to go all the way to the outhouse to pee? Or am I going to take the chance that this house gets haunted? Yeah, I bet you're going for the outhouse. Right? Genius stuff there, right? And then more descriptions, those wind-heaved midnights, right? The thorn tree was cut down, you broke your arm, and I shared the dread when this bird showed up once, right? We didn't know what it was for, right? We were all scared. And then the next stanza, right? That scene, Macbeth, helpless and desperate in his nightmare, right? The witches who are stirring their cauldron and predicting the future. When he meets the hags again and sees the apparitions in the pot, I fell at home with that one. Hearth steam and ululation, the smoky air curtaining a cheek. Don't go near bad boys in that college you're bound for. Do you hear me? Do you hear me speaking to you? Don't forget. And then the pot stick quickening the gruel as steam crown swirled. Everything intimate and fierce while brightening for a moment, then going dull and fatal and away. Right? All these images. And almost every single image we've seen in these previous stanzas is going to come back to us in this next stanza. Right, where Seamus offers his reasoning for why he's not there and this paean of praise to his brother who stays. Gray matter like gruel flecked with blood and spatters on the whitewash. A clean spot where his head had been. Other stains subsumed in the parched wall he leaned his back against. That morning, like any other morning, part-time reservist toting his lunchbox. A car came slow down Castle Street, made the halt, crossed the diamond, slowed again and stopped level with him, although it was not his lift. And then he saw an ordinary face for what it was and a gun in his own face. His right leg was hooked back, his sole and heel against the wall. His right knee propped up steady so he never moved, just pushed with all his might against himself. Then fell past the tarred strip, feeding the gutter with his copious blood. Seamus is referring in this stanza to victim of sectarian violence there in the little town of McGarrafeld, right by the house, right? When a guy just waiting for his car is the victim of literally the sectarian hit. And oh, look, those brains that look like gruel in spatters on the whitewashed wall. We've seen gruel, we've seen whitewash, we've seen the clean spot, right? In the parched wall. He leaned his head back against, and then the explanation there of crossing the diamond is the pedestrian crossing, right? They don't have the parallel lines for it. They have diagonal lines that create diamonds. And he looks down and he gets shot. Right? And he pushes, his body falls forward, losing his, as he says, feeding the gutter with his copious blood, past the tarred strip that we've seen before. And finally, my dear brother, you have good stamina. You stay on where it happens. Your big tractor pulls up at the diamond. You wave at people. You shout and laugh above the revs. You keep old roads open by driving on the new ones. You called the piper Sporin's whitewash brushes and then dressed up and marched us through the kitchen. But you cannot make the dead walk or right wrong. I see you at the end of your tether sometimes in the milking parlor, holding yourself up between two cows until your turn goes past. Then coming to in the smell of dung again and wondering, is this all? As it was in the beginning, is now, and shall be? Then rubbing your eyes and seeing our old brush up on the bar door and keeping going. Here's the final praise for his brother. You have stamina. You have strength that I don't. You stay on where this violence happens, and you act like nothing happens. You pull your big tractor up, you wave at people, you shout, you laugh, you keep the old roads open by driving on the new ones, right? You drive on the new roads, and everybody takes the old roads around you. You call the piper Sporin's whitewash brushes, you dressed up, and you marched us around the kitchen. You did all these wonderful things, but you cannot make the dead walk. You cannot make right wrong. And so I imagine you, at the end of your tether, right? There, doing the jobs that a farmer does, right? In the milking parlor, milking these cows, holding yourself up as you have a spell, as literally the angel of death passes over you until your turn goes past. Coming to, right? Coming to your senses again in the smell of dung, surrounded by these cows in this milking parlor and wondering, is this it? Is this the purpose of my life? What am I doing? As it was in the beginning, is now, and shall be, and if you know the rest of that great doxology, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. What is it, brother? What is it that keeps you there? What is it that gives you stamina? Then rubbing your eyes and seeing our old brush up on the byre door. Seeing that whitewash brush that you used 40, 50 years ago to have fun with us, keeping going. Your memory sustains you. You'll remember these things before they were changed, before they were perverted, before all these images get turned into something violent and dull and fatal, right? Before the dead bodies. You remember these things, right? You are stronger than I am because you remember those things, because you keep by them, and because you keep going.